The Nature Podcast, in association with Bio-Rad. Don't spin out of control, choose the automated solution to purify and desalt affinity-tagged proteins in as little as 30 minutes with Bio-Rad's new Profinia Protein Purification System. Simplify your life at biorad.com/affinity-purification.
Coming up this week, we meet some adventurous Neanderthals.
There might be, if you like, Marco Polo Neanderthals who sort of made it to China and Mongolia, and I think it will be very interesting to look further to the east and the south.
And we look back on the dawn of the space age.
People were waiting for the space age to start. There'd been all the science fiction stuff in books and magazines and films and Hollywood, and then it suddenly happened.
This is The Nature Podcast. I'm Adam Rutherford.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Later we'll be hearing from the so-called sceptical environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg. But first, and it's important that you stay awake during this, a new anaesthetic method has been developed. It uses a combo of two ingredients, one of which, somewhat surprisingly, is capsaicin, better known as the compound that gives chili peppers their kick. Authors Bruce Bean and Clifford Wolfe told me how it improves on current local anaesthetics. Here's Bruce Bean.
The problem with current local anesthetics is that they inhibit the activity of all neurons, not just the neurons that mediate pain sensation, but also neurons that mediate, for example, movement of muscle, neurons that mediate the action of the sympathetic nervous system, neurons that mediate non-painful touch and pressure and so forth.
And your paper reports an anesthetic that only inhibits the nociceptors, the pain receptors. What's different about it? How does that actually work?
Well, the idea was really based on using a combination of two different agents, and one is an anesthetic that only works if it's inside a nerve cell, if it gets inside a nerve cell, and normally it doesn't get inside nerve cells. It just can't get through the membranes of nerve cells, so it actually, by itself, it has no effect on any nerve cells. And what we did was to put that in combination with another agent that opens a kind of ion channel that's present only on pain-sensing neurons. And this ion channel is the one that mediates the hot sensation of chili peppers and of heat itself. That ion channel actually has a pore large enough that the anesthetic molecule can go through it, get into the nerve cell to the inside, and then inhibit the sodium channels only in the pain-sensing neurons.
Clifford Wolfe, what did you actually do to test this theory?
Well, the first thing we did was to take sensory neurons grown in culture and to see whether we could selectively deliver a charged form of lidocaine or lignocaine, which is the most common form of local anesthetic. And when we applied this this molecule called QX314, it was, as predicted, totally inactive because it can't get across the cell membrane. We then co-applied QX with capsaicin and found that this enabled the QX to get into the cell and then only blocked those neurons that had the capsaicin receptor.
And moving on from that then, how were you able to tell that this didn't affect cells involved with movement?
The experiments to show that we didn't affect neurons involved in movement was done in rodents, where we were able to inject the QX form of lidocaine close to a nerve and found that it produced a loss of pain sensitivity without any effect on motor function. Whereas if you inject lidocaine, you get a temporary paralysis in the same way that patients do.
So the rat's movement wasn't affected at all by the drug?
Right, absolutely. Not only were they their motor function completely unaffected, but also they could respond to touch stimuli.
How do you envisage this being used in a clinical setting then?
Well, I think one obvious one that comes to mind probably to everybody is in childbirth, where what you really want to do is to inhibit the painful sensation from the pain-sensing nerves, but still allow sensation otherwise. And also, similarly, probably in dentistry, for example, by limiting the block to pain-sensing nerves, you would, for example, not block nerves from the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, where block of those nerves produces drooling. In these initial experiments, we used off-the-shelf molecules that we knew about that are fairly well characterized. These may not be the best ones to use in a clinical setting if we're able to extend this into using it on humans. And there may be some other agents that, for example, might give longer-lasting anesthesia.
Bruce Bean, and before him, Clifford Wolfe, on anesthetics that won't make you comfortably numb.
Thanks, Kerry. This week sees the 50th anniversary of man's first step into the universe. Here's Jeff Brumfield.
50 years ago, things were pretty swell. Dwight D. Eisenhower had just been sworn into office for a second term, the Frisbee went into mass production, and singer John Lennon met a guy named Paul McCartney at a church picnic. And then suddenly...
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception of how the feat was accomplished.
Out of nowhere, the Soviet Union, then the greatest threat to Western prosperity, announced that it had launched the world's first satellite.
The second stage took over at 5,000 miles an hour.
When the Soviet Union suddenly sent up Sputnik, it was an incredible shock.
Chris Welch is a rocket engineer at Kingston University in London.
The Western world, in particular America, thought that they were in the lead in space and that the Soviet Union was nowhere close.
But after World War II, the Soviets had secretly been making great progress in their rocket program. Under the leadership of designer Sergei Korolev, a team of Soviet scientists built a heavily modified version of the Nazis' V-2 rocket. Theirs was a massive 270-ton machine, but it was never meant to launch a satellite.
Sputnik was launched on a minimally modified intercontinental ballistic missile.
Jonathan McDowell of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
They had plans for an improved version of the rocket, which they were going to use with more powerful engines to launch a serious scientific satellite of about a ton. But when they heard that the U.S. Navy was planning to launch the first American scientific satellite, they pulled out all the stops to beat it. And in just a couple of months, they made a stripped-down satellite, Prosciuszko Sputnik 1, the simplest satellite.
The Soviets were eager to beat the Americans, but the politicians saw little intrinsic value in the satellite itself, according to historian Alexei Kojevnikov.
In running up to the launch, Putin was seen as a little distraction, something that scientists and engineers wanted to do and receive as a reward from politicians for their good work in creating a missile.
But what nobody anticipated was that the public was ready for the era of space exploration to begin. Doug Millard is space curator at London's Science Museum.
People were waiting for the space age to start. There'd been all the science fiction stuff in books and magazines and films and Hollywood and TV. And then it suddenly happened.
Волшебный спутник не просто летает, он трудится.
Met dit enerverende geluid melden zich ook in Nederland de door de Russen in de ruimte geschoten kunstman.
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite. One of the great scientific feats of the age.
The little satellite became an overnight media sensation. Realizing what they had done, the Soviets belatedly began pouring resources into their space program and advertising it to the rest of the world.
I think it really did give the Soviets some street cred that they parlayed into political alliances.
In America, the launch of Sputnik spurred investment in math and science education. It also led to a massive new agency called NASA.
NASA as an institution was, at the moment of its creation, was often referred to as a socialistic enterprise, or the kind of basically as a big bureaucratic government agency. That was supposed to run a certain project in a centralized way by centralizing resources. That was partly the idea how in the United States they thought why and how the Soviets succeeded in their space projects.
A month after Sputnik, the Soviets launched a dog named Laika into space. That success was followed in 1961 by the launch of the first cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin. A year later came the first female cosmonaut, Valentina Tereshkova. The U.S. set its sights on the moon. But as America geared up for its first lunar landing, the Soviets were already losing interest in manned spaceflight. They were falling behind in the arms race and needed to focus on developing better ballistic missiles. When America finally landed on the moon in 1969, the space race effectively ended. Since then, those early dreams of flying beyond the moon to colonize other planets haven't really materialized.
What we're expecting to achieve by now, and remembering films like 2001, A Space Odyssey, fully reusable space planes, it hasn't happened. But, yeah, that is disappointing.
But the era of space exploration isn't over yet, says Doug Millard.
People tend to assume that the space age is almost finished. It hasn't, of course. There's all the unmanned satellites orbiting Earth, doing lots of very important jobs. There's the planetary probes exploring the solar system. There are the telescopes up there peering into the universe. So really, space is alive and kicking. It just so happens that maybe our expectations were raised a little bit too high.
And Sputnik's legacy lives on. Next week, a Soyuz capsule carrying astronauts from the U.S., Russia, Malaysia, and the European Union will launch for the International Space Station. The first stage of the rocket is a modified version of the same ballistic missile that carried Sputnik on its journey 50 years ago.
Jeff Bromfield reporting on Sputnik's 50th birthday.
Coming up in just a moment, those Marco Polo Neanderthals. But now it's time for the podium. Each week, we'll be airing the opinions of a different guest speaker. This week, we give the stage to sceptical environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg.
Prioritisation is an integral part of life. We budget money and time because they're limited. In the hospital's emergency room, doctors use prioritisation, or triage, to save lives. But we don't use prioritisation when we grapple with the world's biggest problems. We know that carbon emissions cause climate change, so activists urge us to make drastic cuts in the CO2 we pump out. Yet climate change isn't the only problem facing the planet. Malaria, malnutrition, and HIV/AIDS are claiming millions of lives right now. In an ideal world, we would have the money and the time to solve all these problems at a stroke. In real life, we don't. Pretending that we can do everything often just means that our money and attention goes to the problems with the loudest cheerleaders or the most media attention. We need to consider how far we should push a particular solution. Making drastic cuts to carbon emissions is similar to making drastic cuts to the speed limits on our roads. Slowing traffic to a crawl would save millions of lives. We could wipe out almost all road deaths overnight. Yet we reject such a drastic step as nonsensical because we accept that it would make modern life impossible. That doesn't mean we let cars go as fast as they want. As societies, we have decided on an appropriate speed limit for our highways after weighing up the benefits we get from the efficient transport of people and goods and then considering the number of accidents. Now we need to have a discussion about carbon emission reductions. Likewise, we should be talking about what we're willing to sacrifice, and what we hope to gain. I believe this discussion shouldn't be left just to climate scientists. We all need to look at the wider picture and remember that global warming is not the only problem facing the planet. We should be asking what policies will best help the world overall. The answers might sometimes be surprising. As an example, we often hear that rising temperatures will mean more malaria. This is true. But is CO2 cuts the best way to help people? For every person saved from malaria through the Kyoto Protocol, the same resources spent on mosquito nets and medication could save 36,000 people. Just as there are many problems facing the planet, there are many possible solutions to those challenges. My belief is that immediate carbon emission cuts are not the best way to respond to climate change. Instead, I believe we should invest heavily in the research and development of non-carbon-emitting energy technologies, which will give our kids and grandkids, and China and India, inexpensive tools to fix climate change by mid-century, while allowing for the continued development of human welfare.
Bjorn Lomborg, whose new book Cool It was reviewed in Nature last month. If you'd like to respond to the podium or make suggestions for topics or guests, you can email us at podcast@nature.com.
Just like smelly cheese and sarcasm, Neanderthals were thought to be quintessentially European, a hominid that stuck to the continent. A new study using mitochondrial DNA sequencing reveals that the Neanderthal's realm was much bigger than previously thought. I'm joined by Nature editor Henry G. in the studio and by lead author of the paper, Svante Perbo, on the phone from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. Svante, set the scene for us. Before your study, what were the boundaries of the Neanderthal's dominion?
So what you traditionally will find in textbooks is that Neanderthals lived in Europe and in Western Asia, pretty much where sort of Caucasians live today. And what we have found is that when we go further to the east, to Uzbekistan and to the Altai Mountains in southern Siberia, you find bones there that contain DNA sequences that look like any Neanderthal that you would find in France or Belgium or Germany.
And these bones were not identified as being Neanderthal bones until you did this DNA analysis?
It was quite debated. I think the child we analyzed from Uzbekistan, most people would have believed it was a Neanderthal, even if it was questioned by some, whereas 1,500 kilometers further to the east in southern Siberia, most people did not believe that that was a Neanderthal. And what we have then done is to extract DNA and look at DNA sequences and compare it to the 13 Neanderthals from which we already had DNA sequences. And we find that there are very typical Neanderthals.
So the locations of these bones, which are in southern Siberia, do you think this is actually going to be the easternmost boundary of where the Neanderthals lived?
Since we now so, if you like, easily have been able to extend their range so much further to the east, I would be surprised if this is the easternmost point. As we say in our paper, it sort of sets a stage for that there might be, if you like, Marco Polo Neanderthals who sort of made it to China and Mongolia, and I think it will be very interesting to look further to the east and the south from these points.
Okay, Henry, if I could turn to you. This is another piece in the Neanderthal puzzle, suggesting that our understanding of this species is far from comprehensive.
Yes, I think Professor Perbo is right. The new findings from southern Siberia, about 2,000 kilometres further east of the previous Neanderthal easternmost record, suggests that there is a lot more to be found in Central Asia and Eastern Asia, whereas most people have concentrated in Europe because that's where the archaeology has been done. Historically, that's where most Neanderthals have been found, and that doesn't mean that that's where they lived only. It could be that we haven't really looked hard enough in other places.
So as we go further east and we use more and more molecular biology techniques, what other revelations are there going to be about other human ancestors?
This is a very exciting question. We know very, very little about the evolution of human beings in Eastern Asia. There are all sorts of very odd bits and pieces from China over a very wide time period and a very wide area. They've been historically very hard to place within the general picture of human evolution, particularly at the time of the Neanderthals, which is very much a Europe-centered discipline so far. So perhaps some of these molecular biology techniques could be applied to some of the Eastern Asian fossils, and they may pick up some early Neanderthal signals. This could tell us all sorts of exciting things. It could be, now this is really flying a kite, and you know, perhaps Neanderthals originated in Eastern Asia. We've no idea. The question of the origin of the Neanderthals is an open question, as well as their extinction. I think this opens up a large number of possibilities of some very exciting research in the future.
So, exciting times for paleoanthropology. Thanks, Henry G. and Svante Perbo. That's it from this week's podcast.
Remember, you can drop us a line at podcast@nature.com with any feedback or suggestions for the podium.
Or your ideas for Sounds of Science. This week, on its 50th birthday, here's Sputnik's first ever transmission. I'm Adam Rutherford.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Thanks for listening.
The Nature Podcast is sponsored by Bio-Rad, at the center of scientific discovery for over 50 years. On the web at discover.biorad.com.